Christmas is always a little melancholy for me. Both parents died on Christmas. Yes, it was decades ago. Sometimes people ask, oh, well, you're over it, right? You do the stages thing? Well, it turns out that stages of grief thing was not true. It was misappropriated. We'll get to that. And what about the millions of Americans who are grieving the nearly 320,000 who've died of COVID-19 and the thousands more who died of other illnesses in hospitals, all cut off from loved ones, in this the deadliest year in America? Hope Edelman is author of the 1994 bestseller Motherless Daughters and now The After Grief. It offers a new way of looking at grief, not as a period on a sentence, but a process that shapeshifts and lasts a lifetime and can enrich us. Hope, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And as we mentioned this to colleagues, you know, several people said, how do we get here? How do we get to this notion that grief ends? And you lay out a fascinating history of grieving. We used to have customs. We put wreaths on doors or spent months in black. Enter Freud, who gets blamed for everything nowadays. But in 1917, he wrote a paper, and this is in the middle of World War I and the flu pandemic. And he said in this paper, in essence, that grief comes to a successful completion. You have to detach from the thing you lost.
You're absolutely right. In 1917, Sigmund Freud published a paper called Mourning and Melancholia. And that paper presented mourning as a very individual interior process. Prior to that, mourning had been a collective endeavor. When we think of Victorian mourning rituals, they were very elaborate. But Freud's paper came in the middle of a 1, 2, 3, 4 punch in Western society, which began with World War I and then the Spanish flu pandemic, and also the women's suffrage movement, where women were gaining more independence because middle-class women were the ones who were predominantly responsible for all of the Victorian mourning codes. And so there was this tsunami of grief. Too many people were dying too close together for the Victorian mourning rituals to still be practical. Also during the flu pandemic, like now, people were afraid to gather. And the society began to think of mourning as an individual process rather than one that was shared with other mourners.
Well, and as you write, Freud had his own epiphany about this when his daughter died at 36. And then a few years later, her young son died, his beloved grandson. And he wrote to a friend and he said, you know what? In essence, I'm wrong. Your acute state of mourning will subside, but you're never going to get over this because why would you want to? It's the only way of perpetuating that love which we do not want to relinquish. That didn't get out, though, as much as his paper did, so we're left with people being called unhealthy or abnormal if they continue to mourn. And then, fast forward several decades, you have Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She came up with the 5 stages of dying: anger, denial, moving through to acceptance. Somehow that got turned into 5 stages of grieving, which is different.
That's correct. In both of these instances, their ideas took on a life of their own. And Kubler-Ross is on the record many times saying, I never intended for grief to be interpreted as a series of siloed emotions. But that idea, just like Freud's, took on a life of its own. It was very seductive in the culture to think this pain has an end point and there's a pathway to getting there. And I thought the same thing. I was 17 when my mother died. I remember looking at the pamphlet of the 5 stages of grief and thinking, check, 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 check. Here I am at acceptance. And this was the day of her funeral.
And it took you decades to have that old grief come back like a boomerang at you, which is what happens. And by the way, I'm so sorry about the loss of your mom at 17. But you say just 2 stages of grief. What are they?
Well, what I've found, it's the one where you feel really bad and the one where you start feeling better. And that one where you start feeling better, which then extends for the rest of your life, hasn't had a name. So we haven't had a vocabulary really to talk about it and acknowledge, yeah, this isn't something that we get over. We find new and different ways to carry our loved ones forward with us. And that's what I'm calling the after grief.
Now, many people who've lost someone think about them every single day. Talk about some of the names that you've assigned to some of these things. I mentioned a grief spike. What are some of the things that should be expected?
When I looked at the different types of grief that I was feeling over this long arc, occasionally I have what is known as a grief spike. Rebecca Sofer of Modern Loss calls them sneak attacks. I think that's a good word too. Those are those moments when you might just be driving in the car and a song comes on the radio that reminds you of your loved one. It's like that gut punch, you know, where you feel, oh gosh, I miss that person so much. It feels like losing them all over again, but it really doesn't. It feels like something else because those feelings move through us. It may be minutes, hours. That's what I call old grief. It is a response in the present to a loss in the past. But there's another category that I call new old grief, which is when we experience an old loss in a new way. And that's typically a one-time event, a graduation, a wedding, becoming a parent. When we long for that person who's not with us, when we long for their advice, we long for their comfort. A big one is reaching and passing your parents' age at time of death, because you are looking back at the same set of facts and you're gaining a different insight from them. My mother will always have died of breast cancer in 1981 when I was 17 and she was only 42 years old. That looked a certain way to me at 17. But I looked at those set of facts very differently when I approached and turned 42. And again, when I passed it, because I realized how very young my mother was and how much she had missed out on. And that's an example of what I call new old grief.
Yeah. You know, all your work is about validating that grief doesn't stop. But you say that not letting yourself experience it, you say this is one of the most undiagnosed public health issues of our time.
I think so.
Why?
We know that grief that goes unexpressed can show up later in life as specific physical and mental ailments like depression, unrestrained anger, hypertension. But sometimes among adults, we cannot attend to our own grief. I believe this is what we are seeing now during the COVID era. I'm deeply concerned about the one-year anniversaries coming up in the spring of the first known deaths to COVID, because so many of us were on survival mode that we could not attend to our own grief. We also couldn't engage in the familiar and comforting rituals that we were used to. So when we go on survival mode, we have to postpone our grief. That one-year point is naturally when people feel a dip anyway, because they realize, I made it through that first year. I've steeled myself against the first year. And now my reward is that I get to do it again and again and again.
Well, so what do people do? We're approaching Christmas without family. I mean, even people who haven't lost loved ones have lost touch with them. So there's some mourning there. But then, of course, the people who have lost loved ones, this is a potentially a profound day for some, or the sense of holiday and you're not with loved ones. You know, you do something with women who travel miles to be there when there's going to be a triggering day coming up for them. And part of it sounds like a 12-step meeting where they go around and for 5 minutes, people can just pour out anything they want to pour out. How do you do that if you're not with a trained facilitator?
Writing it down is the best way to do it. Just free writing. Give yourself 5 minutes, set a timer, write for 5 minutes about something that you've been holding in, something you'd like to let out. Share it with a compassionate other. Just one person can do that for you. It can be a close friend. It can be a family member. Someone who won't ask you, aren't you over it yet?
You talk about talking. If, you know, that person is going to be showing up in your life anyway, you're not crazy if you interact with that, whatever that is, the memory.
No. I mean, the next wave of grief theory that came after stage theory is what's known as the relational theory of grief. The idea that trying to let go of our attachment to loved ones who died was causing more pain than comfort. That in fact, what we naturally yearn to do is find new ways to stay connected to these loved ones as we move forward without them in the physical world. Around the holidays, it can be as simple as telling stories about them or continuing a tradition, even in an abbreviated form, is very important this year, because one of the things that COVID has disrupted is everyone's relationship or form of relationship between the past, the present, and the future. We're kind of in a suspended present tense right now, adjusting to big changes in real time. But traditions and rituals are elements from the past that we can engage in the present with a hope that we will be able to continue them in the future.
Well, there's so much more from Hope Edelman in her new book, The After Grief. Thank you so much for speaking with us about, you know, how to get through it. That's not even right, because that implies an ending too, doesn't it?
Right. It's about how to move forward with it.
Hope, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.